Welcome to the Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today we welcome back our friend Isaac Saul from Tangle. We're going to talk about all things Israel-Palestine. We're going to talk about the Biden administration's new Title IX rules, probably among other things. Isaac, welcome back to the pod.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. Glad to be here.
Well, for folks who haven't, make sure you go out there and subscribe to readtangle.com. Isaac also has an awesome podcast, which I'm a regular listener to, which I think is probably just called the Tangle Podcast. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You can find it just searching Tangle anywhere anybody listens to podcasts.
All right, sir. Well, as we're recording, so just to make this clear, it's Tuesday, May 7th at 3 o'clock Eastern time. There's a lot that could change between now and when this thing goes up. Let's start with what's most important, which is the actual state of the conflict over there. What's going on in the past 24 hours? I feel like it has been one piece of news after another.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we have right now is, you know, it is happening. The kind of Rafah incursion that has been long awaited, and I think by a lot of people in the West outside of Israel, long feared, though there seems to be pretty strong support for it inside Israel. And most of the reports were that, you know, about 36 hours ago now, Israel began dropping these leaflets encouraging people to evacuate Rafah. You know, roughly 100,000 people got them. They covered a pretty large area. And within 24 hours, they began bombing eastern parts of Rafah, which is a city in the south. Some of the border crossings that maybe were marginally or partially open have been totally closed. Israel is basically taking control of the area and started a bombardment that seems pretty similar to what we saw in northern parts of Gaza early on in the war. So, you know, in retrospect, we did not get any indication pretty much ever that this was not going to happen. I think there was a lot of wishful thinking that maybe it wouldn't from folks in the West who didn't want it to. There were a lot of rumors about, you know, ceasefire deals and hostage releases. And, you know, Hamas came out and said that they were accepting an offer that had been proposed by Qatar and Egypt shortly before this incursion began, which I think a lot of people in Israel took as a signal that Hamas did not want this to happen, which for them is probably motivation to make it happen. And Israel basically said, you know, the terms of this deal were not what we agreed to and not something we would agree to, and just carried forward with what they're doing. So it was like this flurry of activity. We got a report that Hamas had accepted this ceasefire deal. And then Israel came out and basically said, this is not a deal that we agreed to. And then the leaflets came and then the incursion happened pretty much all within 24 hours of each other. So it has been totally insane. And I don't think we're exactly clear on where things are on the ground quite yet.
And what do we know about what Hamas had agreed to and what Israel is demanding right now?
It's interesting because Israel has not come out and confirmed really or denied any terms that were released. There was this, I guess you could say, media report. I mean, it came from the Times of Israel about what was contained in the deal. And for the most part, it seemed like a lot of what we had heard, which was this slow drawdown, you know, effectively leaving Gaza over the course of 3 months in stages. And the big thing, according to the Times of Israel, which was the one place that I saw that had some real reporting on this, was this idea that Hamas, the big disagreement was this idea that Hamas wanted basically an armistice, not really a ceasefire, an end to the conflict. And Israel was saying, you know, we're not going to guarantee that we won't come back in at a future date. And then there was also this very important, in my opinion, debate about the hostages that were being released, which essentially comes down to the fact that Hamas can't confirm that they have 33 or 40 living hostages that they're going to turn over as part of a deal. What they've basically said is, will turn over living or dead hostages, bodies of hostages. So there's some question and confusion about how many people are alive that were being held. And it's all very messy. And one of the really difficult things about this is that Israel actually skipped the last meeting that happened in Cairo, the last delegation meeting where these negotiations sort of took place, and ultimately was the last meeting before Hamas said, we agree to this deal, which I've seen one Israeli official on record concede maybe was a mistake, but it's created this sort of gap in knowledge where we're hearing what Qatar and Egypt are saying, and then we're hearing what Hamas is saying, and then we're hearing what US officials in Israel are saying. And the information doesn't all totally line up, and we're relying on reporting from Israeli reporters. But I would say the general outlines were, you know, release of hostages, exchange for ceasefire, and a lot of debate about how many hostages were alive and would be turned over, and whether this would be a ceasefire or, you know, an armistice effectively, which is what I think Hamas wants.
The Economist was reporting this morning that one of the big sticking points was the pace at which they would release these hostages, that Hamas was trying to basically release something like 3 a week and then have like this big release at the end, which you could imagine Israel wasn't too excited about. And that seemed, at least according to The Economist, that was what they were pinning the sort of stalemate on, to the extent that we're in one now. But that they're sending a delegation now to whatever current talks are going on. So maybe something happens. On the last episode, I pointed out that there's this corridor called the Philadelphi Corridor, which is a key part of the sort of border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. And it seemed like so many experts are saying that Israel, over the past 2 weeks, are saying that no matter what ceasefire, if there is one that happens, Israel's not going to agree to anything until they do whatever they need to do in that corridor and shut down whatever cross-border exchanges are going on. And that seems to be playing out. It seems that's like right where they've gone, where a lot of their work is concentrated. And although Egypt saber-rattled a little bit in public and said that they were upset at Israel for whatever they were doing, notably didn't seem to move a lot of military presence in that direction. So maybe they even welcome whatever's going on with Israel in that corridor.
Yeah, no, and I think this whole idea of the freedom of movement of Gazans is actually a big part of this negotiation. The other element was that the Hamas proposal that they agreed to included the movement of Gazans back to the north of the Strip without going through these security checks that Israel had required, you know, which basically they're doing because they don't want Hamas fighters to get behind them or surround them or come back into the north. So that corridor, based on everything that I've read as well, has seemed extremely important to the Israeli officials and important to, you know, whatever the scope of this military operation is. But there's also just this general lockdown across the Palestinian territory and the Gaza Strip that seems to be really key for Israel to agree to any kind of ceasefire, is they want operational security control, which is what Netanyahu has said. Again, I mean, what's kind of been interesting for me is I think we've been dealing in a lot of hypotheticals and we've been taking a lot of, you know, the war cabinet's words and Netanyahu's words as sort of PR stuff, you know, language meant to shape the war. When in the end, it's kind of just seems like they're doing and asking for exactly what they mean. And there's just no wiggle room on it, which is basically, you know, he's been saying, we're going to go into Rafah with or without a hostage deal. It's just a matter of when, you know, we're going to keep troops in Gaza. Once the conflict is over, we're going to maintain security control. We won't allow like the militarization of Gaza. I mean, all these things. And I think it comes through the sort of Western media filter where there's some hope that maybe that isn't exactly what's going to happen. But it seems like nothing has budged on the Israeli side. And Hamas, of course, they're a partner in these deals. If they want a ceasefire, an armistice, they need to be able to come up with 35 living hostages. They maybe could put their arms down or surrender. I mean, there's a lot of things they could do, I think, that would end this war. But it's, you know, just to say it's not entirely up to Israel. But basically, everything's happening exactly as Netanyahu has said it would happen, which I think is, you know, illuminating about where we are right now.
Well, let's turn to the home front here. This week, Columbia University announced that they will not be holding a university-wide commencement ceremony, which was set to take place next week. Isaac, this is a school that charges over $60,000 a year in tuition. if I were a parent, I would not be happy about this. They are, to be clear, having smaller scale school-based celebrations, but this fight goes on. USC had already canceled their commencement. Even the videos of some of the few commencements that have already happened seem to be dominated by this kind of stuff, and protests are actually arriving in the commencements. There was a letter from Columbia University students at the law school that made rounds on the internet where they said, quote, "As the Administrative Board of Student Editors at the Columbia Law Review, we urge the law school to cancel exams and give all students passing grades for their work throughout the semester." And then they ask in the alternative if they could just get pass-fail. They said the violence they witnessed has irrevocably shaken many of us on the review. And they kind of go through and talk about what it is that they have issue with. And this has led to some mockery on the internet, Isaac, between people who are like, you know what I want out of my lawyers? To be irrevocably shaken by the use of state power. That's exactly what you want in your lawyers. I don't want to spend too much time on these debates around is there a right to protest or whatever? I think it's such a tedious debate. And most people who listen to this podcast agree in broad scope that there should be, whether it's on the lawn or somewhere else, people should be allowed to protest as long as they don't resort to violence. But, you know, you've written a lot about this, and I want to get to the content of what the protests are asking for in a second. And you just recently wrote about this and sort of the history of protests. But any big takeaways you have about the methods before we move on to the content?
I think it's really hard to talk about this stuff in broad strokes, which is worth pointing out. You know, I've seen videos from these protests where there's a bunch of students around holding hands and singing and peacefully sitting on the lawn and celebrating Passover and saying Hebrew prayers. And there's this community of Muslim and Jewish students, and it's very peaceful and seems like a normal, totally legitimate protest. And, you know, and on the same campus, 12 hours later, after dark, you know, I've seen the videos of people saying, go back to Poland, and screaming at Jewish students and, you know, being really aggressive and telling people they can't walk through campus and asking people to share some kind of identification or whatever, which is total insanity. And so my general, I guess, North Star here is, if you're the college, you have to have rules that give space for students to demonstrate. Just as a matter of free speech, there should be some bandwidth there. And you also have to make sure that other students don't feel so intimidated or so scared that they can't show up to class. I don't think you can let students take over a dining hall, for instance. And calling in police to clear them out is an aggressive move. But it's also like, this is a building that we need to serve our students, you know, the large majority of whom are not participating in these protests. So you guys can't just sit in here 200 strong and expect us not to come in and clear you out. It's this give and take there. And it is really easy to mock the students. Funny enough, my wife is actually in law school right now, and I was at home and I got the news alert or saw on Twitter about the Columbia students asking for finals, and she's in finals for law school right now. And she was just like, I would do anything for finals to be canceled.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it's sort of like
on those moments.
Yeah.
A group of conservative justices or judges wrote a letter saying they won't hire Columbia students. I think the larger context is this weird state that higher education is in generally. And I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, well, $60,000+, you're not taking the SAT. You're accepting students in ways that are puzzling, right? Something I've written and podcast about so much that our audience is probably sick of me talking about it. But when I see what's going on campus, and particularly like some of these students who they accept, like the student who was like the sort of leader of the Columbia students who had to resign from his position, the guy who did that video where he says he wants to kill Zionists or whatever. And I looked into his background. He was like an anti-testing advocate who went to Boston Latin. And I hear him talk. I'm like, this guy made it through the interview process at Columbia University. And I'd spent 5 minutes with this guy if I were interviewing. And I know not all these schools interview, but they're claiming they want these qualitative metrics. I'm like, what are your qualitative metrics yielding? You know, a lot of people were dunking on them saying, well, okay, that was a seat that some Asian kid with a 1600 on his SATs probably would have gotten before, which I think is a funny little, probably half-truth joke. But I think it has prompted people like, what are these students? What are they doing? They're not taking finals. They're not having commencements. They're charging more and more tuition every single year. Huge swaths of these departments are engaging in quote unquote research that's questionable. And I'm like, well, what are these institutions anymore? And I don't think this is the time to revisit the sort of long history of protests as like, you know, universities being a place for kids to protest. But if I were a parent, and there's a funny SNL skit this weekend about this. If I were a parent, I'd be like, yeah, I don't pay $66,000 a year. I don't want my kid protesting. I want them in a classroom learning and getting a job, you know?
Yeah, totally. There, I saw a very funny tweet that was, you know, a video of these protesters, I think at UCLA or Columbia, one of the places where it's been really hot the last few weeks, building this like massive string construction, and they're all like dancing in slow motion and like wrapping strings around each other. And there's Palestinian flags waving in the background. The tweet was like $60,000 a year tuition for this. Just like imagine being a parent, which like I totally get. I mean, I think it's baseline. I think it's awesome that the students care. And I think that they're responding to a superhuman, normal feeling that we should all be able to tap into, which is like they are seeing war and it's awful. And that's good. We should all have that reaction to the videos that are coming out of Gaza and seeing babies and children buried in rubble and feeling something horrible. Like, I have to do something about this. I think they have a lot, you know, for the most part, they seem probably ignorant about the conflict and are missing the things that have led up to this war, or like the long history of conflict and the ways in which sometimes horrible, destructive conflict like this can actually lead to longer term peace. There are all sorts of nuances there, but I think on net, most of these students are like logging onto Instagram, going onto Twitter, going onto TikTok, seeing absolutely horrific images and feeling like they should join the protest that they're seeing outside their dorm. So I don't blame them for that. But it's also, you know, I think Matty Iglesias wrote a piece about this, like, the kids should go back and study too. Like, finals are coming up. You know, there's a lot of other stuff that's really important long-term in your life you should give some attention to. It is easy to mock the kids who are just camped out there having readings and doing poetry stuff and listening to music. And it's like, okay, they are just, there's something social and communal about this on top of the care for the protest, where like they seem to be having a little bit of fun, which I think is totally reasonable to call out.
Yeah, it's fine, but just like, suffer some of the consequences, right? That's what the no grades and things like this. It's like the student who was out there, who was part of the group that took over Hamilton Hall, asking for food and calling it humanitarian aid and all that.
Why should the university be obligated to provide food to people who've taken over a building?
Well, first of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here.
But you mentioned that there was a request that food and water be brought in, unless I misunderstood.
To allow it to be brought in. I mean, well, I guess it's ultimately a question of what kind of community and obligation Columbia feels it has to its students. Do you want students to die of dehydration and starvation or get severely ill, even if they disagree with you? If the answer is no, then you should allow basic, I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid we're asking for. Like, could people please have a glass of water?
But they did put themselves in that very deliberately in that situation and in that position. So it seems like you're sort of saying, we want to be revolutionaries, we want to take up this building. Now, would you please bring us food and water?
Nobody's asking them to bring anything. We're asking them to not violently stop us from bringing in basic humanitarian aid.
They're stopping the delivery of food?
We are looking for a commitment from them that they will not stop it violently.
But they haven't stopped it yet.
I don't know to what extent it has been attempted, but we're looking for a commitment.
Obviously, poor choice of words, but if you go beyond the words, it's this presumption that it should be easy. And I talked about this the other day on the podcast. Like, my grandfather in India gave up the family business importing British cloth. He had 9 children and he thrust the entire family into poverty. There was a shoot on site order from the British. He had to leave his family for years. He couldn't come back to his village until Gandhi's independence movement won, right? Gandhi himself, as I mentioned, nearly starved himself to death to stop violence, right? And yet these kids, like, they expect to protest, but then also that the protest is going to be catered in a literal and metaphorical sense. And that's where I think they're not doing themselves any favors.
I have to ask, because you had a tweet that got a lot of traction about the fact that that woman actually was a former colleague of yours or worked for you.
You're referring to Johanna King-Slutsky, and she certainly was an activist from the get-go. I think she was with us even during the Floyd stuff and all that, but handled it well. But in part because we always had a standard at Arena when I was running it, which is when I hire people, because it was like a big tent organization with a lot of Democrats of different types, Bernie types, which I would classify her as, and then like more traditional types, that we took no positions on any policy issues. And also that like it was basically like a brushback pitch from the hiring process to say there's no internal activism within this organization. And that's generally been my rule, which is I just don't put up with it. And she very squarely did her thing, didn't cross that boundary at all. But she's always somebody who to me seemed like wanted to belong and, you know, join a protest type thing. And this doesn't surprise me at all that she was doing this. On a personal level, it was jarring to see her, in part because like whenever you see somebody do it, making a mistake, that's like, you know, I think of it like the young woman who tweeted this thing that was racist or something and then went on the plane to South Africa or something and then came out, right? Even though obviously the thing she tweeted was horrible, the reactions online are so crazy and can ruin people's lives that I worry about people even if they make a mistake. So I was just instinctively worried about her, even though I don't agree with so much of what she's doing. I'm just like, I don't want somebody's life ruined because they've become a meme. So yeah, I actually regretted tweeting that because, you know, it's like a personal thing. You know, it's like you don't want to like, there's too much on the internet of depersonalizing things, right? And like dunking on people who obviously are in the worst day of their life. I think she should suffer the consequences of breaking into that building. I'm just worried about like what her life is going to be like now after all of this, if that makes any sense.
It does. I mean, I think it's a really good anecdote for just the way a lot of these viral moments that shape these conversations are often capturing, you know, the worst 30 to 60 seconds of a lot of people's lives. I'm extraordinarily forgiving, I think, of people like her who are in those shoes who become this kind of internet meme or get made fun of, because first of all, it's awful to get dogpiled online. It's happened to me before. And second, it's just, you know, like you said, you worked with this woman, you knew her personally, and she was just like a normal colleague who fit in and did her job and whatever. And now for the rest of her life, she's this person who's going to be defined as like the student who asked for humanitarian aid at the protest, yeah. Which it sucks. I mean, it's like, I agree. It's she made a PR mistake with that comment, and she made a mistake by I think breaking in and occupying this building, but the cost of it seems way disproportionate to the crime, really, you know.
It's wild, man.
Unfortunate part.
It's crazy to think about, like, the world shrinks as you get older. I think you've probably had this experience where it's like, on one end of Manhattan, you've got her, this person who sat next to me in an office where we only had three people, you know, for over a year, I'm sitting next to her, and now she's like this national story. On the bottom of Manhattan is the former candidate who was in the very office basically at the same time, which is Alvin Bragg, who's running the Trump prosecution. And you think when you're younger or whatever, you're like, oh, it would be so cool to like mix it up. And then, but I have a constant state of anxiety for everybody. Like, I'm just like, the world shrinking is not a reassuring feeling because it actually makes you think how fragile everything is, because there's not an other out there that's responsible for things. Like, you are the adults now. We are the adults running this place. And that was the feeling I had that week as all this stuff is going down. It's like, oh my God, like, we are it. There's nobody out there. Like, it's, yeah. For better or worse, the world is us, you know, which is crazy. Okay, you wrote this piece called Protesters Aren't Always Right. This is in line with a little bit of like the kind of discussions that we want to have here, which is, I've said this now a couple times on this podcast, there's so much attention on the methods, but not a lot on like, well, what are these people asking for? Like, and are they right? Let's actually engage in that discussion. Before we get to the current day protesters, you're taking issue at a particular argument, which I've heard a gazillion times, which is, look, the protests in history always seem unpopular, extreme at the moment, but then history always catches up with it, and they're generally deemed correct historically. And you, Noah Smith, some others have written about how, well, that's actually not true.
Yeah, it's a really frustrating argument to just see over and over again, because it's a great meme. You know, it's a great kind of Twitter dunk, is like, oh yeah, like you think the college kids were wrong about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, and look how that aged and whatever. And the thrust of my piece was sort of twofold, which I think on the one hand was, A, protesters don't often age very well. The things they're asking for don't often age very well. That happens. We've seen it happen throughout history. And B, that oftentimes the way people are protesting or their attempts at fulfilling some kind of movement end up backfiring in really terrible ways. And a few of the examples, I guess, that fall under one or other of those umbrellas, or maybe a little bit of both, are, you know, things, and this is one I stole from Noah Smith, was like anti-nuclear protests, which were super common 50 years ago. And I think I could make a really good argument now, looking back on that. It would have been awesome if we had 60 years of building up nuclear power and our infrastructure in the United States. And we'd probably be a lot further along on decarbonizing our country and having really cheap energy if we had done that. And I understand why those protests existed back then, but they haven't aged particularly well, at least not from my view. And I think that's just like a forward-looking protest that felt very progressive at the time that did not really turn out well. And, you know, another one that's a lot more recent, and I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with this, but is the Defund the Police movement, which had incredible support from college students for sure, youth, more progressive Democrats all across the country. And I think it's backfired pretty spectacularly. I mean, all the places that really leaned into that movement and actually made changes to their police departments, not all, I can't say all, but the vast majority of them have basically reverted back to where they were before or increased their funding for police departments now. It's a movement that I think went so far that in the places where it succeeded, what they got ended up not being what they wanted or not being productive for the community, and the communities have rebelled against it. And in the places where it didn't happen, it's like it's being mocked now. And it's so ridiculous, this idea that we're going to defund the police or abolish the police, given that a lot of these major cities now are ramping up police funding to address crime waves and things like that. So those are like two, I guess, big examples that come to mind for me. And then in this piece, I also wrote about a book by Vincent Bevins, who basically just documented all these protests throughout the 2010s, just stuff that's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, where protest movements across the globe pretty much got the complete opposite of what they set out to do, either because the thing they were pursuing maybe didn't age very well, or their methods were really bad, or they awoke this thing on the other side that ended up defeating them. And he points to things like, you know, the leftist uprising in Brazil turning into the most radical right-wing leader in the history of Brazil, or the anti-government movement in Hong Kong turning into a huge crackdown from Beijing. And it's a kind of a global look at all this stuff. But I think it's a really good point. And I think it's just kind of silly to presume that because a bunch of college students all believe the same thing or are protesting in unison about the same issue, that we should follow them or believe that they're going to age well in the historical context. And I say all that despite the fact I'm a Jew and a Zionist who has called for a ceasefire in Gaza and believes that the students are more on the right side of this than the wrong side of this, and will be on more on the right side of this than the wrong side of this. But I just hate the argument that history always looks kindly on these kinds of protest movements, because it doesn't. And there could be a lot of unintended consequences from this, like, you know, maybe the election of Donald Trump, or maybe the isolation of Israel that makes them feel more inclined to act as if they don't need a partner or don't have a partner in the United States, that could give them the opposite of what they're hoping for. It's just a lot more complicated than people seem to want to talk about it as being.
One helpful way to separate it is, what is the sort of content of what the protesters are asking for? And I think in some of the cases that you mentioned, nuclear, the defund movement, there's a lot of, you know, there's a strong case to be made that they were just wrong on the merits. And then in some of these international examples, right, like protesting Mubarak, for example, right, or asking for more freedom in Hong Kong, or some of the protests in Brazil aren't necessarily wrong on the merits, but the way they went about it, the timing, or just maybe they did everything right, and just because the way protesters are viewed at various points, it backfired, or they just weren't effective, and they lead to something worse. You know, like the Egypt one is tough because it's like Mubarak was terrible. So it's like, it's a lot to ask of protesters to be right on all those accounts and also to be prescient about what it is that is going to come after them. But I think the lesson is, what you're doing and what I'm hearing is you're saying, look, the lesson isn't protesters are wrong, period, or they're always wrong. We're not arguing for the opposite of the proposition. We're saying treat all of these independently and also be very careful. This is part of what I see with these protests is, and it's hard to know without really being at a lot of these, right? Where you see these videos where it's like, you see, you know, burn Tel Aviv to the ground videos, or you see this, or you see that, and you're like, well, how representative is this? As you say, I see tons of videos that are totally fine. And I just try to think about, okay, what is the sort of general consensus among the protesters? And is that the correct view or not? And to me, I think there's a good debate to be had, right? Like this decolonial narrative, this sense that I do think that there's a fairly widespread view, if not majority view, about what it means to be Zionist and the legitimacy of the state of Israel, period, even if that majority doesn't believe in violence against Jews, which who knows, right? I have no way to know. And that's like a good debate, is to be like, all right, what's the history? When did Jews get there? Why did the sort of first and second Aliyah happen? And how was the state of Israel formed? And were Jews, did they expel the Palestinians? Did the neighboring countries try to invade? Like, the thing that frustrates me, though, is a lot of these people have no idea about any of those issues. They really haven't examined them. So it's a frustrating debate.
Yeah, it's also worth noting. I mean, one of the things I don't think has gotten enough attention is, like, you know, we've alluded to it a few times, but we haven't said it explicitly, which is what the students are asking for. And one of the things that I've said in my writing is, if this was as simple as a bunch of college students setting up these encampments, going on hunger strikes, occupying buildings, and calling for a ceasefire, an end to a war, this really pure anti-war demonstration, I think they'd find a lot of pretty common support, certainly among people on the left, and maybe among a lot of moderates in the US, especially based on some of the polling that we have. But take Columbia University, which the protests are being organized by a group called Apartheid Divest, which is doing a lot all across the country to organize these protests. They're calling for financial divestment from companies and institutions that, you know, quote unquote, profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation in Palestine. So that's something a little bit separate than just a ceasefire. It's saying, let's punish these companies and apply this pressure. They're also calling for academic boycotts of Israeli universities, reparations for low-income housing for Harlem residents, which is where Columbia is, an end of this targeted repression of Palestinian students, which is, you know, something on its own that I think a lot of people are debating whether that's even happening right now, the defunding of public safety services on campus, and a call for a ceasefire in Gaza from the university. So there's a kind of expansive thing here that's happening where it's like, they're tacking on some additional stuff. It's not just stop this war. And you see from some of the protesters that they don't believe the state of Israel has a right to exist. They, you know, they make it very clear they want Israel to basically dissipate or something. I mean, I don't really know. I don't think it's feasible or realistic, but they want an end to the state of Israel. So there's a lot more here than just stop the war, stop the violence. And I think that is, you know, to the point we're kind of talking about, is something that the protesters are doing that's not necessarily helping them in the long term achieve an end to the war or achieve a ceasefire and the thing, you know, the thing that they seem to want primarily in a lot of ways, which is just kind of plays into this narrative of what they're asking for and also how they're going about it and how that might impact the movement long term.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of this even has to do, and I really mean this on both sides of this debate amongst huge swaths of the population. Now, I don't think it's true, like if you're, you know, friends who are Palestinian, friends who are Jewish or Israeli, like for them, the debate is about what it's about. But I think for huge percentages of the people engaging this debate, I wonder whether this is about what's happening in the Middle East anymore. When I look at the debates, it's about American identity politics. It's about DEI. It's about universities and their place in America. And what's fascinating is, and this is as true, we'll link in the show notes, I interviewed this guy from Gaza. I know you actually tweeted about him the other day. He lost multiple family members in this conflict, even going back before October 7th, but since October 7th too. And the way he talks about it is so much different than the protesters. And he's also like really embarrassed by the protests. And this is no friend of Israel, right? But the way he talks about it is way more specific and tangible, and also more generous in a weird way, even though he's lost more to this conflict than anybody else, which is really remarkable for him. But I think this is kind of a debate about us because we're so vain as Americans. We've turned this into like, okay. And honestly, I actually think it's a debate that's a long time coming, right? Like what's going on at these universities? And I think it took something like this for a swath of the left to understand the consequences of some of the ideas they've allowed to blossom within the left. You know, I saw these back in 2015, 16 when I was running schools and organizations like Teach for America were dismantling achievement-based sort of methods and ideas and, you know, moving away from tangible teaching techniques and all that to more activism. And I got into these huge brawls with some of these organizations that were purporting to be education reform organizations, but who are smuggling in sociological gobbledygook, right? And I think like 10 years later, basically, I see the evidence of it everywhere. Up until recently, it was basically like, you've got my friends on the left, I come from the left, basically. And then you've got the Ron DeSantis's, and there's been not a lot of room in between, right? It's like the Rufo's, DeSantis's, and then this sort of Ibram Kendi's and Robin DiAngelo's. Well, now there's this whole new group in the middle, and this would be a perfect time for like a political realignment in a sane world. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but it does seem that people are agreeing with each other more in the middle publicly than I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, no, I think there's common ground there in that sense for sure. And again, as it relates to this conflict specifically, Israel is certainly degrading their reputation in the US. And I think there's a lot of people that these protesters are maybe missing that would be receptive to a simpler, more anti-war grounded message. And certainly, you know, when it comes to sending money to Israel, that kind of thing, direct US support for military assistance or humanitarian assistance. I mean, we're watching it happen in Ukraine right now, where Republicans are really effectively messaging on this idea that we should be spending that money here. I think those things have a wide, broad, you know, supportive audience across the country. But when you have the images coming out of some of these protests coming out, and you have the complexity of some of the demands, and sort of, for lack of a better word, just the immaturity of some of the protesters that comes through in like these viral videos, they just become a lot less sympathetic, which is, you know, it's unfortunate for them and unfortunate for the dialogue too, because we're often just focusing on not the core issues, but how cringy some college kid is, basically.
Let's talk about college in a different context here, you know, in a weird way related to DEI debates, which is this Title IX policy change that the Biden administration is floating. What's the basic background here? We've never covered Title IX, I don't think, on this podcast. It's one of the few issues we've never gone near.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, there's a really robust kind of history around Title IX and the debates around it. And it is, to me, actually a pretty fascinating kind of story about unintended consequences of major federal laws. But effectively, Title IX, which is really short, it reads, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." So it's a 1972 law, basically just says that you can't discriminate against someone on the basis of sex, and also receive federal funding. And one of the big impacts of Title IX, and maybe the most well-known impact of Title IX, is the way that it's impacted women's sports at the collegiate level. A lot of colleges have basically ramped up their women's programs in order to not be violating Title IX. You know, the kind of very simple way to put it is just if you're a woman who goes to a school with a men's college basketball team and there isn't a team there for you to play for, that's a situation where maybe you are facing discrimination and the school has to, you know, kind of remedy that. And it's been a huge boon for women's athletics in the long term, which I think is an unintended positive outcome of this. What's basically happened in the last few years under Trump is, and then Biden, is that there's been this back and forth volley about how to handle Title IX. And Betsy DeVos, who actually did a lot of stuff people don't really talk that much about anymore as education secretary, she implemented a few changes to Title IX and interpretations to Title IX that were pretty significant. One of the big ones was how college campuses handled allegations of sexual assault or sexual harassment on campus. And she basically made new rules. And, you know, I say she, but the Trump administration made new rules that bolstered due process for accused students and also reduced the legal liability of schools. So they laid out rules for how schools should conduct impartial investigations of students who had been accused of sexual assault on campus. And those rules were kind of a response to what Obama did, which was gave the schools a lot of latitude to prosecute kids, basically with, you know, a single arbiter who served as judge, jury, and prosecutor. And, you know, one person could investigate this claim and then decide that a student was going to get expelled. And a lot of kids who were wrongfully accused of sexual assault or harassment sued schools and won lawsuits. And this is something that a lot of people fought over. And the Trump administration tried to remedy this by, you know, bolstering the due process rights. And the Biden administration is basically trying to strike a middle ground between Trump era and Obama era policies on that issue. And in the midst of doing that, of course, also touch some of the trans issues that are pretty explosive on college campuses right now.
What is a trans issue on college campus? You know, I sound like an old man, but like what, outside of the athletics context, like what, where did trans issues come up on a college campus?
So the big thing is that under the new rules that the Biden administration has just implemented in Title IX, trans students who say that they're subjected to a hostile environment through bullying or harassment, something like being called a name that they no longer associate with or a pronoun other than the one they have chosen, something like that happens to them over and over on campus, where they get excluded from programs based on their gender identity, can now trigger an investigation by the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. So effectively, what the Biden administration did is they acknowledge Title IX, you know, sex-based discrimination in the context of gender identity also. So they expanded the tent to include trans students. They cited Bostock versus Clayton County, which you probably know more about than I do, but, you know, landmark 2020 Supreme Court ruling, which basically brought in gay and transgender people into the Civil Rights Act for workers who are, you know, facing workplace discrimination. So that's kind of the legal justification they're shooting for. And they did this all while not touching the issue of trans students in sports. So I think
basically leaving it up to the individual schools and athletic commissions, essentially.
Like, yeah, while they pursue a different rule that they say is going to address that issue. So it's sort of two-pronged. The big news that came out of it was two-pronged. It's they changed the way schools can deal with sexual harassment and assault allegations. And they also brought trans students under these Title IX protections where, you know, gender identity constitutes sex in the context of Title IX. So if a student who is a trans woman wants to participate in, you know, an activity that is supposed to be exclusionary for men and is told that she can't participate in that activity because she's trans, she could sue the school. If somebody, a professor, refuses to call her by her chosen pronoun, she can sue the school. It's basically giving them that kind of protection, which, you know, obviously in today's world is a very controversial thing to do.
And as you sort of score this change, is this progress? Is this regress? Like, what is this?
Interestingly enough, I'm a little bit split. I mean, I'm have a lot of faith that the Biden administration's well-intended on the issue of the bringing in trans students under the protection of some of these civil rights protections. And I think there should be repercussions if, you know, a college administrator or professor refuses to call a trans student by their preferred pronoun. I mean, aside from just being a huge dick thing to do, I think it's basic decency that we can probably offer some sort of protection for. But the big issue with what they've done is they haven't really defined gender identity anywhere in these rules.
Before you go off of that, now that you're saying this, this isn't in my view, but I feel like it should be represented, is, you know, the Jordan Peterson, you know, this kind of Jordan Peterson got famous, I think, was he was fighting against like a more extreme version of this in Canada. And what he argues is, and again, this is not my view, but I want to represent it, is that this is a First Amendment violation of the professor. And I might be butchering Peterson's position, I hope not, is that he's saying, forcing me to use that pronoun is forcing speech, is what he would argue.
Yeah, and I think that's an argument that is going to be used when Republicans and conservative states file lawsuits against these changes, which they've already done. I think the bigger issue is just that a rule that's addressing this, something as complex as this, there can't be a ton left open for interpretation and wiggle room. And by not defining the most core thing, which is, you know, if you're going to say that gender identity is similar to or should be treated similar as sex, which Title IX is always interpreted as this binary thing, male or female, then what is gender identity? How do we define that under the law, which they didn't do anywhere in the rules? So that's just going to be problematic and open the door, I think, for a lot of lawsuits and complexity and probably more culture war fighting over this. My position on the sexual assault stuff is actually a little bit simpler, which is that I think the change is bad. And the reason I think it's bad is because I actually think the Trump administration had this right, because there needs to be more robust due process rights for students who are getting expelled or suspended from colleges. And, you know, a lot of them effectively having their life and career prospects ruined. Lots of these cases go public, even if they never go to an actual criminal courtroom, where the student's name is all over the internet as a potential sex offender. And a lot of these colleges get the cases wrong. Often, you would imagine, more often than a judge and jury and trial might. And so what the DeVos administration basically said was, you can't have one single person who investigates and prosecutes and decides what's happening here. You have to have certain due process rights in place. So whether it's giving a student representation in these proceedings, whether it's having multiple people who are involved in the investigation, whether it's having the accuser actually have to undergo some sort of cross-examination or testimony, which I understand why that's very controversial, but, you know, in a criminal case, that's the kind of thing that happens. And I think the stakes are high enough that we should treat it not unlike a criminal case, because it matters so much to get things like this right for the students involved. And so what Biden's doing is basically saying that colleges can determine how they want to handle this thing and should act according to state law and all this stuff. But in practice, what it's going to mean is that a lot of colleges can implement these, you know, single person investigations, often people who are part of DEI programs or administrators who, I think, based on everything I know, will have some sort of inherent bias oftentimes to the accuser. And I think that's really important. And, you know, I say that all understanding that sexual assault on campus is a huge issue and it's still underreported. And we should be doing everything we can to make sure we're protecting people who are victims of sexual assault. But I don't think we can sacrifice the due process rights of the accused in a really big and major way, which I think this rule is doing, unfortunately.
I think this whole area is a mess. You know, you think about historically, I have no doubt that the accusers were more wronged than we had, like, sort of instances of overzealous prosecution. I think things started to turn around the time of the Duke case when I was in law school. This is the Duke lacrosse case where Lord knows how our society would have handled that today.
God, it's hard to imagine.
People could look it up. There's a great documentary on it. And it involved race, privilege, and all this kind of stuff, false accusations. But there was enough there that our society would have grappled onto it. And some people would, I have no doubt that some people would look at that with today's eyes and say that was rape, right? Even though the kids were basically exonerated, right? But because of the privilege conversation and all that kind of stuff. But then at the same time, you think about powerful football player does X, Y, and Z. And I won't name names here, but there's plenty of history of even players who've retired in recent memory who have had pretty head-turning accusations against them that kind of disappeared over the years, where you're like, okay, wherever there's power or something for a university to lose, or they're just overwhelmed, or there's litigation, you can always worry about whether they're going to try to sweep something underneath the rug. And so you're like, all right, we want to protect the accuser. But then you have hysteria. You have, you have cases where like it's just not popular to defend somebody accused of a heinous act. And so unless you have the protections of something like the criminal justice system, that hysteria could at times claim innocent people. And I think it is, there's no doubt that that's happened. And then you have like these thorny debates, like what you're talking about around, well, what do you do with an accuser, right? If this were a criminal trial, as you said, you are entitled to face your accuser. In this case, in the case of universities, even though it could ruin your life, your name gets out there. And even like if you're eventually exonerated, let's be honest, like having that out about you ruin your life too. It's tough because you're also talking about some of the worst crimes imaginable, right? And society generally doesn't handle these things well. And so my sense is like where things are going bad, meaning there's impunity for crimes, I still think that happens in certain places. And then where things go bad because there's like, very loosey-goosey process and overzealous prosecution and major political bias about privilege and yada, yada, yada that seeps into it. I think that goes bad too, which is why this seems like a rather hopeless area.
Yeah, I definitely don't leave feeling optimistic when I read about it and sort of consider all the options. And I think, I agree with a lot of what you said there. And I think one of the things that I sort of come back to is, how do we handle this stuff in criminal court? And to what degree should the way colleges handle this stuff mimic that? And, obviously, when somebody's freedom is not on the line, maybe it doesn't have to be handled the same. But I do think that the consequences for sort of being quote unquote convicted, even on the college campus setting, is high enough. This like expulsion, suspension, public stories about it, all these things, social isolation, prospects for work, all these things are so important and so significant that I think whatever we're doing should kind of approach that. So, we want to protect the accusers in the sense that we don't want to re-traumatize them. We don't want to, make them relive this thing or have their name get out on campus and all this stuff. But we also need to make sure that we're doing what we can to ensure the people who are being accused are getting a fair shake. And interestingly enough, this is something a lot of due process advocates have supported about the DeVos education secretary tenure, is that she made this change. And a lot of them are very opposed to the rule changes that Biden just made, which I think is unusual because a lot of those due process rights groups are often sort of liberal or left associated, and they've come out and kind of opposed the rules, which to me is a good tell.
Yeah, I think in the final analysis on this, I think the rule you should always use here is if you had a family member who was the victim, and then you have a family member who is the accused, what process would you want, and can you meet somewhere in between those two? Right, like you obviously. If it were your family member, you'd want vengeance. If it's your family member who's accused, you'd, be tilted in favor of trying to keep it as discreet and due processy as possible. Now, how do you find something in between those two things? And can you find something that actually would satisfy you in both cases? Which is why smart due process, not onerous due process is always the move, like a reasonable amount of due process that still allows for swift adjudication and detailed adjudication of these types of things makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I've never heard that test before, but I like that. I'm gonna steal that from you.
Well, okay, again, everybody go out there and check out readtangle.com and the Tangle podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Isaac, great to see you as always.
Thanks, Robbie. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe, and leave us a voicemail with your thoughts on the show. Our number is 321-200-0570.